morning we're doing a class on Christian ethics. And we've looked at a number of different fields, but in the last several weeks we've looked at the whole issue of politics. And this will be the last session on this particular topic. It'll probably be a couple more weeks as well. There's a lot to cover. And as I said at the beginning of this particular section on ethics, this is not about how to vote. It's basically, or who to vote for. It's basically gaining an understanding of how a Christian should think about their relationship and responsibility to the whole political arena. And I know enough of you to know that there are some very strong political feelings in this class on both the right and the left. And I'm going to make both of you angry before I'm through. I'm determined to make everyone angry before I'm through. America, in the minds of many people at one time, was to be the new Jerusalem. The question is it becoming the new Babylon? And a recent poll by the Pew Research Center suggested that we're slipping in the wrong direction. The number of Americans who self-identify as Christians has dropped nearly 8 points in the last 7 years. That's dramatic because up until that point, there was not a great change in the number of people who would identify themselves as Christians. One conservative commentator put it this way: if this continues, the future of Christianity in America looks very bleak. But there are many others, as you can imagine, that were shouting for joy. The effect organized religion has had on American politics has been utterly toxic. The Christian right has tried for decades to impose its harsh Old Testament views on the entire country with its war on women's reproductive rights, and gay marriage. In a modern world torn apart by medieval religious extremism, who wants to be affiliated with intolerance? Dallas Morning News reporter. In reality, however, when you basically dig beneath the surface in terms of where these statistics come from in terms of the departure from Christianity generally, you find out that in reality the drop has been largely associated with mainline denominational affiliation. Evangelical churches have not dropped in involvement. Independent churches have not dropped. Independent Christian organizations or religious organizations have not dropped. There's simply been a shift in terms of where people are going. Michael Garrison put it this way: we are certainly seeing a collapse in casual Christianity and a religious belief as a civic assumption. In other words, you can no longer assume if you're American you basically belong to a church. That's no longer an assumption that can be made. And the idea of casual social Christianity is falling out of favor. People now, if they're involved generally because they are serious about their faith. George Marsden, who is a professor at Duke and an evangelical Christian, Christian historian, put it this way: liberals have learned that it's difficult for a church to survive if there's nothing that makes the church distinct from the culture. And I think that's largely what's happening in many mainline churches. They simply become a chaplain to the real new priest, which is political correctness or the latest thing that comes out of the university, in a secular sense. Now, to understand something about this whole area of the Christians, or especially the evangelical Christians' involvement with civic society, we've got to understand that we are citizens really of a number of different arenas. In a sense, we are all, as the Apostle Peter says, aliens in this world. In that sense, we are chosen of God to be members of His family, members of the kingdom of God. Our ultimate allegiance comes as citizens of the kingdom of God outside this world. That kingdom is not of this world in terms of ideology or values. But we're also citizens of the world of humanity. We all share the image of God in a broken world. And we are citizens of a particular nation. Most of us in this room are American citizens. This is our country of origin or our country of residence. In that respect, we have obligations in all three of these areas. As U.S. citizens, as members of the human race, and ultimately as the kingdom of God. So in Matthew chapter 22, when Jesus basically talks about rendering to God and rendering to Caesar, he's talking about an obligation that we have in all these spheres. Sometimes those spheres are competing. But let's just look at for a moment at probably the most well-known statement that Jesus makes about politics. And that is the rendering to Caesar, the things that are Caesar, and to God, the things that are God's. Some of you are probably aware of the fact this came as a response to a question that was asked by those who were trying to trap Jesus concerning the paying of a poll tax. That's the context. And a poll tax was basically a head tax. It was a flat head tax on every individual to fund the activity of the Roman government, and specifically the pleasure of the Caesars. The tax was particularly punitive to the poor because it took a larger percent of their income. And for that reason, the Jewish people, who were numbered among the poor, many of them, basically revolted. And the origin of Zion, or Zealot, or the Zealots in Jesus' day, had its roots in this poll tax and the protest against it. Now, a number of questions are raised by what Jesus says here. First of all, as Americans, we have to ask the question, were the circumstances that led to the American Revolution similar? Very similar in many respects. Not identical, but similar. How much injustice from the state was Jesus willing to tolerate? Not just for himself, but for the poor among his people, the nation Israel. And what do Christians owe Caesar when the state is a democratic republic? In many respects, America is not like the Roman government. We are the government, ideally. We basically have a role in the government, supposedly.
Yeah.
So that to be absent from that role is not to render to Caesar. In America, many would argue, and I would agree, that we have an obligation to Caesar in the sense that we have an obligation to be involved in civic government. Now, the bigger question that arrives once we get past Jesus' statement about Caesar and God is the question of just exactly what does the Old and New Testament say about politics? And I want to summarize it with three words. But the first thing I want to say is this. Very little. Very little. We'll talk about this next week, perhaps more. But woefully little is said by Jesus or the apostles in terms of political involvement in the state or in the nation. What it does say is this, that the New Testament speaks a lot about social ethics. But the social ethics are parochial. That is, the attention is given to the inner dynamics of the covenant or faith community rather than the culture outside the church. There's a lot said in the New Testament about how we relate to one another, about our social connections, our forbearing with one another, our serving and loving one another, so forth and so on. But almost all of it, I would suggest there are very few examples that are addressed to our context outside the Christian community. It's all within the Christian community. The same is true of the Old Testament. The ethics socially in the Old Testament are directed toward Israel and how Israelites relate to other Israelites. When it comes to the Canaanites and the Egyptians, the rules change. The rules are not normative. The second is pacifistic. When it does address the Christian's relationship to the state, the posture before the outer secular political world is one of peacemaking. We talked about this last week. The primary call in all the passages that deal with our responsibility to the state call us to make peace, to submit rather than revolt or reform. And for two reasons. One of them we talked about last week. So that we might live in peace. So we might be able to follow God, be obedient, without obstruction. Now, you say, well, what does that mean when culture is unjust? We'll be talking about that today and next week, Lord willing. But the emphasis is decidedly in all the passages, Romans, 1 Peter, 1 Timothy. The call is for being peacemakers. The third P is personal. Ethics, social ethics, focus on the inner heart of the individual soul. The interpersonal relationships that we have with one another, not on political revolutions, movements, or systems. This is where Christianity, in many respects, is biblical Christianity, is unique. Many religious systems, like Islam, for example, have a strong military component. And other systems, other religious systems, oftentimes are linked with political systems as well. Christianity is conspicuously centered on the heart of the individual and how the individual's relationship with other individuals impacts and creates a social environment. That is unique. I know you've had questions about that. I'm going to try to convince you that this is the case. Again, I'm going to reiterate Plato's comment, which we looked at last week. The penalty good men pay for indifference to public affairs is to be ruled by evil men. And again, underscoring the fact that in a democratic republic, rendering to Caesar is not withdrawal, it's involvement. A democracy and a republic invite us, demand that we be involved in ruling ourselves. As Christians, we don't have the option of withdrawing. 5 points I want to make. The first is this. Rendering to Caesar in America means involvement in shaping public policy. Last week, I talked about the four major components that become the root system of our culture. One is the Enlightenment ideals of individual freedom. Two, classical representative government, coming from Greek and Roman models. Three, the religious wars of Europe and the conflict between church and state, or the conflict that came from uniting church and state in Europe. The pain of that shaped a lot of America. And then finally, a biblical moral values and worldview that was brought by the Puritans, largely, to the American continent. This had a legitimate place at the table. America, I'll argue, was never an evangelical Christian nation. But at the table, in terms of its root system, there was this very strong moral component that came from the Judeo-Christian tradition, reflected in what we would call biblical ethics. It's interesting to note, for example, of all the many references to the Bible in Washington, D.C., there are virtually none referring to Jesus Christ or the New Testament. Almost all of them, I don't know of an exception, refer to the law of Moses and to the moral law, which is shared largely by other religious traditions as well. And as a matter of fact, when you look at the role that the Ten Commandments and Moses play in the architecture of Washington, D.C., it's largely as symbolic of natural law, or the laws that are shared by religious groups and even non-religious groups throughout the world. Again, we'll talk more about that in a bit. Some people have described America as progressive, patriotic Protestantism. Now, it's no longer probably that narrowly defined. But for many years, that's the way America was viewed. Progressive in the sense of liberal, changing, dynamic. Patriotic. America was exceptional. It was unique. America was the standard. And Protestant. In the early years of American civic life and cultural life, Protestantism basically was assumed to be the standard. If you're Catholic, you're kind of on the fringe. If you were Jewish, you're on the fringe. If you were
one of the many sects of Christianity or some other religion, you're on the fringe. Protestants rule. That's
changed a great deal. Now again, by way of review, what do Christians owe to the state? And I would summarize it this way. Support and yet separate. Church and state are separate. God and Caesar. Render to God what's God's, Caesar what's Caesar's. But, as Paul says, as Peter says, we are to support the state, pay your taxes. Jesus did not say withhold the tax and protest. He said pay the tax to Caesar. It's his money. Also, submit and yet scrutinize. We are called to submit to authority as though we have understanding that God has ordained authority. Even Hitler, even Nero. The statements in the New Testament are written under Nero's reign, of all people. And Peter, who would be crucified by Nero, not personally, but by his policies, asked the followers of Christ to submit to the government, to state authorities, and to pray for them. But there's a sense, too, in which the church always had a prophetic posture in the culture. It scrutinizes. It calls the state a state. But, again, it takes the posture not necessarily of reforming or revolting, but basically being a light and salt. But the question that we're going to be looking at today is this. How can the Christian also shape the culture? If we're a part of a democratic republic's government, do we not also have, and I would agree we do, some role in shaping the culture? One way or another. Christians shape the culture, I'm going to argue, by their example as salt and light that they let the world taste and see. Now, this is different than basically revolting and reforming. The reform, perhaps, but the reform comes by being example before as opposed to infiltrating and using power to manipulate. Passages. Three passages we'll look at briefly. Matthew chapter 6, Sermon on the Mount. Jesus speaking. You are the salt of the earth, speaking to his disciples, his followers. But if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It is good for nothing anymore except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do men light a lamp and put it under a peck measure, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Here he tells his disciples, his followers, us, we are salt and light, and he says, let your light shine. Now, what in the world does that mean? Well, we can look at some other teachings of Jesus. John chapter 17. As thou didst send me into the world, this is his high priestly prayer before he basically goes to the cross. He's praying for his church. As thou didst send me into the world, I also have sent them into the world. Notice, I'm sending them the same way you sent me. So the way in which Jesus operated in the world is a model for our operating in the world. And for their sakes I sanctify myself, that is, set myself apart to you, God, that they themselves also may be sanctified in truth. I do not ask on behalf of these alone, but for those who believe in me through their word, that they may all be one, even as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, and they also may be in us, that the world may believe that thou didst send me. And the glory which thou givest me, I have given to them, that they may be one, just as we are one, I in them, and thou in me. And that they may be perfected in unity, that the world may know that thou didst send me, and didst love them, even as thou didst love me. Disciples were not to withdraw from the world. That's the first thing we see here. He's saying, basically, I'm not asking you to huddle up and find a cave. He's saying, I am sending you into the world the same way I was sent into the world. Don't withdraw. Jesus' model was the model for us. He was not military. He was not militarily a leader or politically a leader. He basically came as someone who was on the outside of the halls of power in many respects and stayed there. When he called his disciples to follow him, he called some of them from outside the halls of activistic power. There was a zealot among the disciples. Paul was a person who had some status in his community. But Paul basically left all of that to follow Jesus. All these things that were an advantage to him in terms of the power structures of the world, he laid aside that he might know Christ and be found in him. He could know Christ in his words, or in his thinking, only as he left those halls of power. Now, Jesus was not saying, basically, if you're a ruler, you must, or a soldier even, you've got to stop being a soldier or a ruler. But he was suggesting that your real power is not in the halls of power. Your real power is basically in what you have by my Spirit in the kingdom. Christian witness was to be through relationships within the faith community. By the way you relate to one another, specifically your unity, the world is going to know me. If it knows me at all, it's going to know me by the way in which Christians act. Now, boy, that is a real problem. I've often told people, if it was just for the church, I wouldn't be a Christian. If the only witness to the gospel was the church, I would not be a Christian. I hate to say that, but just being honest. I am a Christian because of Jesus, not because of y'all. No. Or not because of me. I mean, the fact is, when we look to one another, we're going to be disappointed. No, we're going to be encouraged too. You know, I am very thankful to be a part of the body of Christ. And many of you in this room and many other people have had tremendous influence on my family and on me. As vessels of the Holy Spirit and of the Word of God's truth, in ways in which you have never would never suspect or realize, that goes without saying. But we all know that the church is a mixed bag of broken people. We're broken people in a broken world, and there are a lot of inconsistencies. There's a lot of hypocrisy. There's a lot of stumbling and falling. This is why the New Testament teaching on social ethics is laced with words like forbearing with one another. Why in the world should we have to forbear with people who are sanctified? Well, the point is, we're not that sanctified. We need to forbear with one another. We need to serve one another, forgive one another. Forgiveness and forbearance are the Christian F words. And they're the words, basically, that have been forgotten and unused, unfortunately. But they're needed, desperately needed. The third passage. 1 Corinthians 1. For consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble. There were some, but not many. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things that are strong. And the base things of the world and the despised, God has chosen the things that are not, that he might nullify the things that are, that no man should boast before God. And here Paul reminds the Corinthians, who thought they were basically reigning with Christ, that they basically had been given the right to reign and to have dominion in the earth. Paul was reminding them, listen, look at yourselves. You're the weak in the world. You are the things that are not. You're the things that are despised. God has deliberately chosen to use you in the same way that his Son came, not in power and glory. His Son came as a servant, died as a criminal, never escaped the basically lower echelon of society. And he called you to be the same and find power in the midst of that. Why? Because in God using that kind of person, that kind of profile, He mocks the false power of the world. That no one would boast. There are basically two benefits in God choosing the people that are not. People who are not powerful and shining. One, it basically prevents them or discourages them from becoming puffed up and proud of themselves in terms of what they've accomplished or who they are. Secondly, it basically mocks or shows the real weakness, the real failure of the powers that be in the world. I've often said that what's happening in our culture today may very well be not Satan's work, but God's work. America's biggest problem is not sexual promiscuity, it's not abortion, it's not materialism, it's pride. We're convinced that we are so exceptional that the world should be like us, if it's not already like us. Our foreign policy tends to mirror that. We just assume everybody wants to be like us. I don't think God is that impressed with that pride. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised to when history's secrets are unfolded in eternity, we'll look back and we'll say, this is why America was never mentioned in biblical prophecy. It just was not that all that much. Matter of fact, it was just a whole lot of hot air. And I think a lot of the world is beginning to see that American hypocrisy is real arrogance because we never will admit it. And when a president does admit it, he gets castigated for blaming America. Now, certainly, there are a lot of virtues in America. A lot of the values of America are unique and wonderful. They come from Christian roots. But America is made up of individuals. We are fallen people like everyone else. And we are citizens of the humanity of the world in a way in which we don't want to admit. We are not that exceptional. Our flesh is the same flesh as those who live in the Soviet Union, who live in communist China, who live in Borneo, Burma, so even in Canada, Mexico. Same folks. We're citizens of one another in that respect. And specifically, our real citizenship, most important citizenship, is our union in Christ. This is why in this passage and in others, it is that union. It's not our political union. It's not our geographical union. It's our union as Christians that basically is the source of the power of our witness. And I think for that reason, we do well to invest a lot of our energy in terms of how well we treat and relate with one another before the world. Jesus and his disciples generally worked outside the halls of political military power. The disciples followed Jesus' example in this regard. Paul basically laid aside his advantages to follow Jesus. Peter's personality was one of being a zealot. But when you read 1 Peter, there's nothing about a zealot's spirit in 1 Peter. And when they did have the world's power, they took the role of a servant using kingdom power in its place. Again, the example would be Paul, where he basically left everything to follow Christ and to know him. Dietrich Bonhoeffer put it this way. To believe the promise of Jesus that the followers shall possess the earth, and at the same time to face our enemies unarmed and defenseless, preferring to incur injustice rather than to do wrong ourselves, is indeed a narrow way. And that has been the posture of disciples for years. Charles Colson put it this way. Christian patriots spend more time washing feet than waving flags. Or carrying guns, we might add. Now, don't get me wrong. I have 9 guns. I'm a hunter.
Just nine.
But I would be the first person to say military power or that kind of force is not the way of Jesus. I'm not saying you can't own a gun.
I use guns as a sportsman. I hunt with them. Don't care too much for animals except eating them. But other than that, the guns don't serve any purpose for civilians. I'm going to go. Second point. Respect the conflicting voices that are deeply embedded in American culture. American culture, as I said, is not an evangelical nation. But it does have a place at the table for God-centered biblical revelation in the sense of the values and ethics that come from the Judeo-Christian tradition. But they are pitted against a lot of the values that came out of the Enlightenment, which is man-centered to a large extent. Secular pluralism, we might describe it as. And we're going to talk about that in just a moment in terms of how they are similar and how they are different. But there is real tension here. The tension between man-centered and God-centered is built into the American system. And I think we've got to understand that. We've got to recognize that both places have a seat at the table. Those on this side say these people don't belong at the table. Many on this side say these people don't belong at the table. Both have a place at the table of the American system. Some have described America as a secular state with the soul of a church. And it captures that idea. There's something privately and personally deep down inside the soul of the American culture that looks like Judeo-Christian in its values and practice, even. But yet, there is a strong current in a different direction as well. Richard Neuhaus describes the tension and the difficulty in terms of communicating in that tension with these words. Richard Neuhaus, how many of you are familiar with Richard Neuhaus? Okay, many of you are. Richard Neuhaus was a social liberal Lutheran pastor who later in his life became a neoconservative. And the late Richard Neuhaus, very articulate. He became a Roman Catholic later in life as well. Interesting story. But he changed his political views dramatically later in life from socialist to conservative. He says this: what we have so often in modern political and religious discourse are communities of differing worldviews speaking past each other without ever making meaningful contact. And what he's saying basically is, in the media, in political rhetoric in our country, largely there is simply a food fight. We have two sides, conservatives and liberals, who have dug a trench and are hurling ammunition basically at one another, not listening, not understanding, just trying to eradicate the other as being illegitimate. And that's the point that is frustrating, or should be frustrating, to all of us. The separation of the state and any one religious sect was the intent of the Founding Fathers. That tension between public policy and sectarian faiths was built into the American experience. But the Founding Fathers understood the separation of state having to do with any one religious sect. The Church of England was not basically to be in bed with the state in terms of political policy. There was to be freedom of religion, all religions that share a common worldview, and even atheism and materialism were included in that context of religion. I'm going to show a quote from Chuck Colson in just a moment, where he cites the Supreme Court's definition of religion. But the point is this: some wrongly believe that atheism is not a faith and therefore is tenured into public policy. So it should be a separation from all formal religions and secularism and atheism as having a tenured place in public policy. That's part of the tension in terms of worldviews. Here's Chuck Colson's quote. The Supreme Court's working definition of religion: a sincere and meaningful belief which occupies in the life of its possessor a place parallel to that filled by God. And in that respect, a materialistic worldview — by materialistic I don't mean wanting houses and cars,
I mean measuring everything in terms of not the spiritual, but the material. Everything can be measured by chemistry.
Space, time, energy, matter, nothing else. Yes?
Is this what Chuck Colson says, or what the Supreme Court has somehow...
This is what the Supreme Court has said.
The Supreme Court.
That's the operating definition. That's an operating definition that the Supreme Court has used in describing religion or defining religion. Jim Wallace, who I'm going to be quoting again later, interesting person. His first book, Agenda for Biblical People in the 60s, was that's when I first had contact with him. He was a very strong activist against the Vietnam War, and his writings were a powerful call for Christians to basically take a bold stand in social justice issues. Had this to say, and there are a lot of points that I disagree with Jim Wallace on, but I think he's a popular spokesman. If you watch news on cable television or main network television, you're going to see him once in a while show up as a spokesperson. Some people believe the alternative to bad religion is secularism, but that's wrong. The answer to bad religion is better religion, prophetic rather than partisan, broad and deep instead of narrow, and based on values as opposed to ideology. And that's what he would argue for as the problem in our present political structure. But the point I want to make broadly is this. Separation of state from any one religious sect is not the same as separation from any notion of transcendent spiritual authority. In other words, the founding fathers, in separating church and state, were interested in separating or making sure no sect of religion, no denomination, like the Anglican Church in Britain, became linked with the state. There was a separation in terms of particular sects, but the idea of a sacred canopy, a generic god, a general religion, is the way Jefferson described it, was to be tenured into American culture. The way in which some people might view it would be this. The American model was between England and France. The English model was the union of one religious sect with the state. The separation of all religion from all public life was the model France took, a radical separation of religion or theism from the state. The U.S. basically was somewhere in the middle. For people on the left, they tend to believe the founders were more like the French, calling for radical separation of state from any religion or external authority. People on the right tend to believe the founders were more like the British, calling for common law, biblical ethics to be tenured into national public policy, not in our life, if not a particular sect, certainly Judeo-Christian values had the right to occupy that space. Again, G.K. Chesterton summarized the gut feeling of a lot of Americans this way. The poor have sometimes objected to being governed badly. The rich have always objected to being governed at all. And that's generally true. Those of us who are comfortable don't want any changes. Those of us who aren't want all kinds of changes. That's only human nature. And I would suggest that's something Christians should be weary of and not fall victim to. How do we try to remove this tension between the secular, the religious, the values that come from a Judeo-Christian tradition and those that come from Enlightenment, man-centered tradition? Well, there are four big models that are used. We can divide them in terms of a little separation, which integrates church and state, and liberal Christianity has tended to do that. A lot of the main denominations have fallen into this pattern. The state sets the agenda for the church. What's politically correct? That becomes the moral agenda for the church. The church becomes a chaplain for the ever-changing values of the state. for example, gay marriage. It would have been unheard of even a decade ago to have the kind of popular posture that gay marriage does today then. Even our president mirrored this. He came into office, he was opposed to it. Now he's for it. He reflects the culture in many respects in this regard. Now you're seen as a bigot if you're not supportive of gay marriage. Whereas in our parents' generation, that would be an unheard of critique. And this has taken place rapidly in our culture. The point is, churches basically tend to follow that in the liberal tradition. In the Roman Catholic tradition, there's a tendency to see the church as having dominion over the state. This is why, for example, in Roman Catholic countries, church and state are largely connected, strongly connected. This is why, for example, the view of the church in a Roman Catholic model is of a parish. All the people in an area. And this is why when Roman Catholic scholars argue for social or political ethics, they take the teaching of the New Testament, apply it directly to the country. The Sermon on the Mount defines our foreign policy. The Sermon on the Mount was written to disciples of Jesus Christ who found their hope in the next world, not in this, and who basically were willing to die for themselves and live for one another. That's not where America is. And until we are, the ethical teaching in the Sermon on the Mount basically is not going to work for us. But the point is, if you assume that Jesus' social teaching to the church applies to the world, then you're going to be forced to deal with that kind of thing. The Reformed tradition is different, but only in terms of methodology. The Reformed tradition basically comes from the Puritans and the Presbyterian tradition by and large. The church is to reform the state by infiltrating the state with to positions of power. Be elected to office. Campaign for the right issues. Change the culture from within. Use the power of the world. Because after all, God is Lord of all, including government. Therefore, we have a dominion mandate in terms of the arts, in terms of education, in terms of the government, so forth and so on. That is the teaching largely of the Reformed tradition. The fourth is the Anabaptist tradition. The Mennonite, Moravian, Quaker, Baptist, some Baptists, so forth and so on. Where the church is the salt and light of the state. That is, it affects the culture from the outside. Now, many people mistake, for example, the Mennonite tradition as basically withdrawing from or isolating itself from culture and not getting involved. I would argue this. In the best of the Mennonite tradition, that's not all what is going on. It looks like withdrawal. It simply has a different strategy in terms of how you change the state. You change it by being a model of something radically different. And I think it's seen at points like the example of the lead mine disaster in Pennsylvania with school children being massacred by an embittered, deranged person. And the way in which the Mennonite community responded to the person who killed their children. Within the same day, they were reaching out to the parents of this man and wound up starting a fund for his family, so forth and so on. There were not only the grace that was shown, but the rapid response of grace that was shown in forgiveness to one who had killed members of their own family stood as a stark, stark light in a dark world. And much of the world could never understand who was crazier, the guy who did the killing or the Mennonites who so quickly forgave him. And to this day, many people would say, these people are crazy, just like they did early Christians. The point is, that has an impact. It had an impact on not just American culture, all over the world. Now, in terms of the Protestant tradition, we're somewhere in here, most of us. And we're all over the map on different things. But I find myself you know, in here someplace. I might call myself an enlightened Anabaptist in the sense that I find myself in as I get older with greater sympathy for this position. But understand this position is, and I understand I'm mixed up with a lot of this stuff. That's why I make everybody a little uncomfortable. Four, appeal to common grounds in civic debate. One of the biggest mistakes I feel that we make as evangelical Christians in the political arena is the fact that we don't understand how to talk about politics. And I would suggest that we start by getting clear of one thing. When it comes to the tension between the Enlightenment and Judeo-Christian worlds, there are three things at least that we share in common. And this is very, very important. Reason over superstition, respect for the individual, and common sense. These are deeply embedded in Judeo-Christian tradition. They are also deeply embedded in the Enlightenment. And the two undoubtedly influenced one another. Many would argue that Christianity gave birth to the Enlightenment in respect to these things specifically. They opened the door to replace superstition with reason and respect for the individual, not just the state or the church leadership, and appeal to common sense, good science. But there are also some real differences. And we've got to be aware of the fact that these presuppositions really do make a difference. In the Enlightenment, these presuppositions tend to prevail. One, natural insight only. The idea of any kind of supernatural revelation, unless it makes common sense, is basically nonsense. Or the problem, basically, is external, the environment, and the solution is external, political, to man's problems. This is why, for example, out of the Enlightenment, we have conflicting ideas. The individual is free to do whatever they want. But when they get in trouble, it's the environment's problem. And someone, politically, has got to solve the problem for us. Now, that doesn't make sense. But both of those ideas tend to come out of the roots of the Enlightenment. The Judeo-Christian tradition sees things somewhat differently. It does not deny the importance of natural insight, but it includes supernatural revelation in terms of its understanding of reality. The problem is seen as internal, our sin nature, and the solution is internal, spiritual, repentance, reform, through the work of Jesus Christ and His Spirit. These differences are significant, and they're assumed. Oftentimes, people over here assuming this, and people over here assuming this, are using this to argue, but they're getting nowhere. They're missing one another in the night. As Christians, we need to be aware of this, and in constructing our conversations, be sensitive to how reason, respect for the individual, and common sense are going to be seen in light of both sides. I would argue that the clearest example of American civil religion, that is, the kind of religion that comes out of our Democratic Republic Constitution, is Freemasonry, the Masons. Robert Bellah's phrase, American civil religion, I think is best described in Freemasonry. Reason, religion, righteousness. The Freemasons, I know many of us view the Masonic Lodge as a cult, probably is, by some definitions. But Freemasonry is a social organization, by and large, that's committed to American generic religion, or generic values. Our bills, we have a new order has begun. A lot of the symbolism, the dollar bill, basically looks very similar if it's not copied from Freemasonry. The idea is the essence of rational, moral religion, virtue, courage, loyalty, prudence, truthfulness, compassion, and so forth, these are common to all religions, and they all common sense, they would argue. Those best minds of the Enlightenment would embrace this, they would say. And the best minds of Christianity would embrace this, and of Buddhism would embrace it as well. But the point is, this is what, if there's an official religion in America, it's probably going to look like Freemasonry. Now, there's a starting a debate there, but we're not going to get into that. Examples of common sense arguments. I'm just going to just throw some things out. Without a biblical ethical spirit, capitalism becomes the exploitation of the poor by the rich. Newhouse. He'll come to me next week. Democracy becomes an endless litigation of rights or the marginalization of the minority by the majority. Without a Christian rudder, this is what democracy becomes. Just get a good lawyer. Pluralism dignifies every kind of digression as a form of creativity, because there's no judge. We have preferences, and we're creative. And if you've got power, you basically can sell your idea. And competition without the cooperation and compassion of community is counterproductive. Did I get enough C's in there? Competition makes our economy grow and go. But, from a Christian standpoint, when it doesn't involve cooperation, that is fairness, compassion, dealing with the poor, those who are left out or aren't competitive for some reason, and does not see it as a part of the health of the whole community, not just the individual, it's counterproductive in terms of society. Three books that I would suggest. Jim Wallace's book, God's Politics. Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. Well, really, what he's saying, the left doesn't get it because it's not left enough. It's basically what he says. He confuses the church with the state, in my view, in his book. But he's a good writer, and he speaks for a lot of people on the evangelical left. If you want to go to the other side, you can go to Wayne Grudem's book, Politics According to the Bible. Really, it's Politics According to Wayne Grudem. The first part of the book is really quite good. It goes through biblical passages and handles them, I think, well. But the last two-thirds of the book is his own personal politics, which is basically a carbon copy of right-wing Republican. If you're so inclined and you want a manual to remind you of what you believe, but again, it's counterpart to Jim Wallace's book. And again, I'm a fan of Wayne Grudem. I think his systematic theology is great, and a lot of the stuff he writes I admire and like a lot. I just don't think that... and I don't necessarily disagree with all of his politics. I just think that it's not quite as simple as he would like to make it. This is the book I would prefer. The political, nonpartisan perspective of Chuck Colson. Now, again, I don't agree with everything in this book, but I think it's more balanced, insightful, sensitive, and balanced. He calls Christians to be involved politically because it's our obligation in a democratic republic. But he is very careful to recognize that you don't, you shouldn't, you can't identify Christianity with one particular party or one particular political ideology. You're going to wind up being embarrassed at the end of the day. Because who knows what and how God is working in our society? Here is the final point. Model what I call a 4G operating system. 4G OC. Shape the state by appealing to four things. The common good. Liberty and justice for all. With an emphasis of liberty, individual freedom as much as possible, justice. That is, being fair to those who aren't competitive, especially in a free market system. and to all. Don't leave anyone out. Common goals. To reach the common good. The tendency in politics to say is if you don't have our goals, you aren't interested in the common good. Listen. Liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans, many of them have the same goal. They just have different ways of understanding how you get there. And when we basically ridicule people who don't do it our way as not having the right goals, we do a disservice to the American system. Common ground, caring, respect, and responsibility. Meet one another with respect. Learn to listen to one another. We might learn something. Most of the reading I do is from people that I don't agree with. I might learn something. I'm convinced that there's much more that I can learn from people who disagree with me than from people who already know what I know. And common grammar. Use common facts. Use common reason. Honesty and listening. I would say listening, listening, listening. If you don't understand a person who opposes you or objects to you, listen until you do. Unless they're crazy. And of course, many of us think that people who disagree with us are crazy. You know, again, there are two types of people in the world. There are people who are like us and people who should be like us. But that, it just doesn't work that way. Now, your notes will tell you the details. Building a church community, being salt and light, starts with not changing our system directly, but indirectly through being a model. Go public with your model. Let your light shine. Show faith, hope, and love in your response to life. The world learns a lot by watching the way you respond to things the world doesn't respond to very well. We have a different response to the world's fallenness than the world does. That's where our light shines. And civic involvement. Play your part to the government. And you can see the rest in your notes. Some of this will be... What? Yes, Bill.
Most, it seems to me, if not the vast majority of those who have difficulty with being the salt of the earth in terms of involvement in the country, in society, are those people who find it in that this kind of involvement places too great a risk on the lives of their children. And I wish you would address that.
Too great a risk to the lives of their children in the sense of?
In the sense of the inability to preserve the faith and the integrity of the lives of their children. That their children get it when they get involved in the world, it impacts their children in a way that's threatening to the identity of.
Yeah. Or when parents get involved politically in political things, as I understand Bill saying, that puts children in a difficult position. That basically puts them at risk in terms of their own development. I would put it this way. It's not do you get involved, it's how do you get involved. I think the way in which many evangelical Christians get involved is pretty toxic. For the adults and for the children. And it invites a reaction. I think what our children need to see from us is involvement that really mirrors the kind of involvement we see in Jesus. With the kind of insight into power that we see in Jesus. And the kind of spiritual hope that basically transcends the horses and chariots of politics and military hope. That is something our children need to see. And matter of fact, they desperately need to see that. They don't profit from our withdrawal or from our involvement in a toxic way. But that's why I'm doing this class. To straighten y'all out. I'm just kidding.
Well, now that he's done that, it's time to recognize it again.